They were given the choice of siding with justice or siding with terror. And they chose to side with terror.
26 days after the attacks of September the 11th, America and Britain have launched the military campaign against Osama bin Laden and the Taliban regime.
These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
It was in early October 2001 that the then US President George Bush launched his so-called War on Terror. Just 2 weeks later, Steve Jobs launched the latest innovation from his technology giant, Apple.
To have your whole music library with you at all times is a quantum leap in listening to music. And this is what the front of it looks like. Boom. That's iPod. I happen to have one right here in my pocket, in fact. There it is, right there.
In that time, the MP3 player has become a ubiquitous bit of kit for any soldier deploying to war. My name's Jo Fidgen, and for the BBC World Service, I'll be exploring the influence of portable entertainment on the experience of warfare. Have a quick listen to Brandon Neal and Stephen Taylor, both fresh from active duty in Afghanistan.
I had a little MP3 player and a mini DVD player, so my friends were sending out Quadrophenia, American Dad, and a bit Family Guy.
I do actually have about four or five different playlists. I've got one named as Training, so that's all your sort of dance music, all sorts of stuff to get the heart pumping. And then I had one called Sleep, and it used to be your Johnny Cash type of stuff. I've got all sorts.
My name is Terry Charman, and I'm the senior historian at the Imperial War Museum, London. We are in the Ashcroft Gallery, devoted to the men and women who won the highest British gallantry awards, the Victoria Cross and the George Cross. And we're in front of the case now, devoted to Staff Sergeant Olaf Schmidt, who won the George Cross in Afghanistan in 2009.
He was leading a team like this one when he died, dealing with a homemade device near a British base. It's the area targeted most often by the Taliban's bombmakers. On a single day in Sangin this August, Sergeant Schmidt found 31 IEDs while clearing the most perilous road in town.
We have in the case the iPod that he used during his time in Afghanistan because it helped take his mind off the intense job he had to do. I think that music and warfare are intrinsically linked and have been through the centuries. In the First World War, in the dugouts, a lot of officers did have portable gramophones. Then in the Second World War, we have radio. And of course, nowadays, we have iPods.
My name's Captain Doug Beattie. I've been in the Army for just over 33 years now, and I have served that whole time with the Royal Irish Regiment throughout the world. I deployed to Afghanistan in 2006, and I had this iPod with me when I went, and I used to show it to the Afghans, and the Afghans were totally amazed with this thing, and they always tried to buy it off me for a couple of goats, but I never parted with it, and I've retained the songs on it as well. But it takes me back to a moment in time. It takes me back to Garmseer in southern Helmand, to a small ruined agricultural college where we lived, to a small half-dug grave which I slept in because it's the only cover that I had. It takes me through a journey which was my Afghan experience, where we really were engaged in fighting from compounds surrounded on the rooftops, just really scrapping it while the enemy closed in on us. Bob Marley's One Love reminds me very much of my interaction with the Afghans whilst I was down there. On many occasions they would come up and sort of say, put on your music, BT, and you know, I would put on One Love for them each time, and then they would laugh and try to sing along to it. And it was nice to see, but you know, when you're sort of playing your music and they're sort of saying, no, I don't like that song, put this song back on, and you put One Love back on, and then the next song comes and they say, no, I don't like that, put that one back on, and you have to put One Love back on again. So you end up listening to One Love about 10 times until they've finished their dancing or they get a little bit bored of it.
6-0 Alpha, 6-0 Alpha. Be aware, those mortars are danger close. They're on, but we are receiving some of that frag, over.
Patrick Hennessy was in the army for 5 years, serving in Iraq in 2006 and Afghanistan in 2007.
Alpha, 6-0 Alpha, that was spot on. We're now observing for any enemy movement, over.
First few times, we were in a sort of old-fashioned shooting match. I remember thinking, gosh, this is just like when you're trying to get through a club and get a bottle of water from the bar and you can't hear or see a thing. Although with slightly more extreme consequences, I guess. Listening back to Armin van Helden, it certainly has that kind of urgency to it, which very powerfully I associate with the actual experience of a contact itself. There's a long history of people trying to come up with imaginative ways to replicate the confusion and the urgency and the adrenaline without obviously just shooting at your own people. But it immediately struck me that if you were to take a platoon of 30 soldiers down into a proper supercar with a good big sound system, and then if you set them tasks, right, you know, you've got 35 seconds to get across this heaving dance floor that you can't see properly because there's a strobe. How do you communicate and how do you cut a rational path through something which is as consciously detaching itself from rationality? So looking back at the sort of stuff we used to listen to, you know, there's a real bias towards dance music effectively, which would seem to be counterintuitive, but I don't think it is.
Yeah, I think that works, because I was just wondering,
My name's Sean Langan. I'm a documentary filmmaker.
Sean spoke to the BBC World Service from the cutting room of his latest documentary.
Right up top, but I actually like
it. I set out to be a documentary filmmaker and ended up covering the war on terror. I specialise in Afghanistan, and as a result, once 9/11 happened, I was kind of the go-to guy for Islamic extremist insurgents, whatever they're called. And so I spent the next 10, 12 years covering Afghanistan and Iraq. Even though I didn't listen to music too much when I was on the ground with the British soldiers being shot at, bullets flying and the sound of RPGs and mortars going off around me, that's the only soundtrack I needed, and I actually wanted to hear that, thinking it might help me survive. Before going down, I would put headphones on in my hotel room, and I would often listen to Josh Wink, Eyes Shut, and imagine all hell breaking loose. And that track seemed to go rather well with all hell breaking loose. Because at night time, when you're under attack, you've got helicopters, you've got NVG goggles, you've got light beams, red beams, explosions, and it's pretty terrifying. And it really helped bizarrely focus the mind. And it's rather sort of full on discordant techno beat, kind of got you in the right mode. I.e. tensing your muscles and hoping you're not going to get shot.
We were just driving along the ridge and came under fire. Had to get out of the car. The Taliban were in these trenches about half an hour ago. Now we're in them. They're firing at us.
In 2006, Sean made two films in Afghanistan, one following the Taliban, the other on the front line with British troops.
When you're with the British soldiers, in fact, the way to really get on with them and bond with them is to put yourself as far forward as you can in the firing line. And once you've done that, it really changes. So when I first went with this British team in Helmand, it was in this Battle of Garmsa, this strategically important town, they call it, but to me it looked like a dust bowl. 17 British soldiers accompanying 100 ANA, Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police, were very wary of me. And over the process of this week-long battle, by mucking in with them and being prepared to put myself in the firing line, we bonded.
Bring it forward with a gun.
One of those 17 British soldiers captured on Sean's film, Fighting the Taliban, was Captain Doug Beattie, who won the Military Cross for his courage and leadership during that operation.
At the edge of the tree line, I want you to engage with the 50 cal.
It was on the 5th anniversary of the Twin Towers atrocity, and we were literally fighting from the moment we crossed the open plain and they started shelling us with rockets to us crossing the canal and the fighting starting in earnest. Our contact lasted non-stop for 36 hours. There's no structure to what's going on. It really is frenetic. But there's a clarity to it that if you get something wrong here, then you're going to die, or one of your men is going to die. And as you're sort of picking your target with your machine gun, you squeeze the trigger and you watch your target fall. And then you say, right, leaving that for a moment, and you flick your map open and you start looking for the grid references that you're going to give the guy who's at the top. But as you're doing that, you can hear the bullets going over the top of your head from the enemy. And there's no fear because you are so busy. But then there's a fear when the JTAC says stores. And that word means the aircraft that I just gave the coordinates for have just dropped the bomb and it's on its way down. And you have that horrible, sickly feeling that if I've got this wrong, this is going to land on me. And you literally count it down. And the fear is endless until the detonation. Then your heart leaps again and you're back up and you're firing again. And most of the time, you really just want to hide. But as a commander, you can't hide. And it's not just because you're a commander, but it's because you are so incredibly busy that you don't even notice.
Just surviving something that you weren't 100% sure that you were going to survive or not is an incredible release, and it's a euphoric release. But it's also slightly empty euphoric release, and almost like post being sick. It's a sweaty, bad tasting release, that metallic tang in the mouth which we associate with adrenaline, which is actually ultimately one of the reasons why I left the army. I loved my career there, but I could see how seductive that high and that come down became after a time, and you'd grow accustomed to it, so you'd find a more extreme version and a more extreme version, and you'd come to a point where actually you were sort of living for taking risks, and that was not necessarily what a good soldier did.
War zones offer little opportunity for privacy, but a pair of headphones helps create the illusion, at least, and many soldiers appreciate the chance that affords for quiet reflection. But Patrick Hennessy also values the experience of gathering around a screen as he and his colleagues followed the trials and tribulations of a Second World War parachute unit in the TV miniseries Band of Brothers.
We watched the whole series of Band of Brothers up in Patrol Base Inkerman, about 8 kilometres up the road from Sangin, which was an extraordinary thing to do in retrospect, because it was the most difficult period, probably the whole tour, in terms of being in this defensive posture, getting a hammering, taking casualties. You know, it was a difficult base to be in. We would have been watching episodes of Band of Brothers, sat on the floor of a dusty stone room, maybe cleaning a weapon with a laptop perched on one folding chair that happened to be kind of acting as a little table, hoping that the generator didn't conk out, which it would tend to do every half an hour or so. Probably in that sort of winding down time, getting your heart rate down and everything. We'd been together as a team for 6 months by that stage, and that was what you were subconsciously or consciously aspiring to, that kind of sense of togetherness.
As a journalist living in Kabul, unlike the soldiers or the Taliban, when you're not filming, we would get on a helicopter back to Kabul. Kabul, throughout the last decade, was ironically probably the best party capital in the world. Because you've got 3,000 to 6,000 foreigners, doctors, NGO workers, journalists, spies, mercenaries, all gathered together, not knowing whether they were going to live or die the next day. And that makes for a great party. Every week it'd be the Oxfam or the Medicine Sans Frontier party. And in those parties, you would dance and party like there was no tomorrow, and you'd let off steam. And the big track I remember was Eric B. and Rakim mash up with the White Stripes. And that really got the crowd going. The DJ is a Swedish NGO worker. By day, he was trying to reconstruct Afghanistan. By night, he was a rather temperamental, high-maintenance DJ who would stop playing if people didn't dance properly to his tracks.
In Kabul, Sean Langan was surrounded by people all sharing the experience of the war zone. But Patrick Hennessy didn't find partying so easy when he returned home to the UK for a short break halfway through his tour of Afghanistan. All troops are given a two-week R&R period during their six-month tour of duty, and it can be a sharp culture shock.
We ended up spending about 24 hours just literally stuck on these roofs with not much real prospect of getting down because they were sort of swarming all over the place. And after a kind of very, very long night, out of nowhere, the message came on the radio, oh, and by the way, Hennessy, you're home for R&R.
2 weeks. 2 weeks.
So you're literally jumping in the back of a quad bike to pick up your kit.
Hopefully not getting shot at for the first time in about 10 days. Bar. A glass of champagne in the bar, I think.
And in about 48 hours, I was back in my flat in London. Extraordinary deceleration, you know, kind of like slamming the brakes on in a Formula One car and just feeling everything fly past and being utterly discombobulated. A friend of mine had a birthday party, and the smoking ban had been introduced while we were in Afghanistan. So like, when we'd flown out, you could smoke anywhere you want, and when you came back in, you couldn't. And it probably saved me, actually, because I was able, wherever we went, the excuse of, I've got to go outside and have a cigarette, was what allowed you to stand in the air for 5 seconds and kind of breathe, because you'd kind of get these moments where you think, it's just all a bit overwhelming.
Doug Beattie did 3 tours of Afghanistan and particularly remembers the difficulty of coming home for R&R in 2008.
It was late at night, and I remember going to my house and going to the window. And you know, at night time, when it's really dark and the glow from a window, and it's just so incredibly homely. And I remember looking inside and seeing my family sitting in front of the television. The fire was going, the dogs were there, but there was a real happiness in them. And I probably stood there longer than I should have. And I suddenly realized that in a minute's time, that happiness was going to leave, because I'm going to re-enter back into their life. And although they'll be happy to see me, and there'll be tears, and there'll be cheers, and there'll be hugs, that will last for a minimum amount of time. And then unhappiness would kick in as I get ready to return to Afghanistan again. And for a moment, I genuinely thought I would walk away from my own house and say, I'll give them the night, and I'll come back the next morning. But I decided not to, and I went to the door, and exactly as I expected, you know, I was met by my family. They overwhelmed me slightly with their love and attention, and everybody was happy. But then the countdown started. I only had 14 days, and I felt that guilt of doing that to them, of breaking their routine, and then dashing it again as I went back to Afghanistan. So it is incredibly difficult.
The war that Doug Beattie was fighting in 2008 has changed dramatically. These days, Afghan security forces are bearing the brunt of frontline duties. British forces are due to withdraw by the end of this year, so troops deploying now face a very different battle. August 2013, an army training camp, Salisbury Plain, England.
The Afghan army in Helmand is showing themselves to be without doubt brave, competent, confident, and able to plan and execute their own complex operations.
A new deployment of soldiers is about to leave for Afghanistan. Brigadier James Wooden will take command of Task Force Helmand.
This has allowed the current task force to press ahead in the process of disengaging and to close those bases for which there is no longer any operational need.
At Salisbury for this final training exercise are a new generation who have grown up with their life in their back pocket. Games, music, films of friends go with them everywhere. For these fresh-faced soldiers, creating the right playlist is an essential precursor to battle.
I'm Lieutenant Javis Crisp. I'm from 158 Royal Anglian. I'm actually a reservist. I'm a recent graduate, and I have in fact been downloading music like no one's business in preparation for the tour. Because I think there has to be that music that reminds you of home. I think there's a lot to be said for states of mind and in listening to music to do certain things. So I do have kind of like a set that I like to listen to when I'm packing my kit up, because it puts you in the right mindset. There's a band called Mum, and they do, I guess you call it kind of montage-esque music. It's a bit Sigur Rós-y, Swedish-esque. there's the Ballad of the Broken Bird record, which puts me in a kind of focused mindset.
Robin Darcy joined the army 3 years ago, aged 16. This is his first tour, and he's already planned what he's taking.
Games. Just little finger ones that pass the time. Nothing that involves thinking. Football ones in the goal, do you know what I mean? I don't like puzzles or anything like that either. Or reading. West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountain. I got a mixture of music from Frank Sinatra to rock to rap, hip-hop, everything. Depends on what mood I'm in, or what time of day it is, or whatever it is. Older than the trees. I probably put on a bit of John Denver, Hit Me on the Country Road. Country roads, take me home to the
place I belong. Well, that guy's going to be out there for a long time this time, 8-9 months, which will bring with it particular stresses and strains for them, but more particularly, I guess, for family and friends back home.
Ian Rogers is one of a team of Padres also going out to Camp Bastion with Operation Herrick 19.
One of the privileges of being a Padre is that we sit outside the chain of command. So as such, soldiers, officers, regardless of who they are really, can talk to us without feeling the same pressure perhaps as they would do in other situations, and perhaps discuss stuff that they might not necessarily be comfortable talking with their mates about or with the chain of command.
My name is Lieutenant Tom Doe. I'm part of 2 Medical Regiment. I'm very excited. This is going to be my first deployment. I'm hopefully going to be saving lives. It's quite a lot of responsibility. I think it's going to be my family and friends I'm going to miss the most. And I don't think I've been as long away from my parents as this before. And I'm missing Christmas, which is the first one I'll ever miss. Being an officer, I should have a lot of classical music, and unfortunately I fall into that bracket. My top one would have to be Mozart's Requiem in D minor. I think it's so evocative. It's got elements of soaring inspiration, but also the lament. When you're feeling sad and you just need something to resonate with you, I think that really, really works. There's nothing better than being able to, you know, kick off after a long day and just lose yourself in whatever book you're reading at the time. Sci-fi and fantasy are my favourite, but I'm spending a long time out there, so I may as well brush up on some of the classics as well. So let's see if I can get through Jane Eyre, but I doubt it.
With kit bags packed, films downloaded, and playlists created, the troops are ready for battle. Coming up after the news, we'll find out how they're getting on and whether the wealth of home comforts on offer helps blur the line between home and war zone.
Science on the BBC World Service.
Molecular biologist Bonnie Bassler is a world specialist in bacteria.
Life on Earth is microbial.
And how they communicate.
Different bacteria can take on different jobs, and so they communicate so that the entire consortium actually survives better.
In a special event at a London school, she'll be talking to philosopher A.C. Grayling and taking questions from young people in the audience and around the world.
We've got a question now from Diego in Mexico.
How can we manipulate bacteria communication?
That's a fantastic question. You want to work in my lab?
Inspiring a future generation of scientists.
If you like the idea that you will be the first one to ever think about something, and that you actually might change Earth by doing that, you should be a scientist.
Exchanges at the Frontier. Online at bbcworldservice.com.
In a couple of minutes, My War, My Playlist continues.
He would always be forever young, whereas I will grow older and I will slip into insignificance.
A new generation of soldiers has deployed to Afghanistan, armed with MP3 players, laptops, computer games, all the trappings of life at home. But does being surrounded by so many home comforts make the experience of warfare easier or harder to bear? Join me, Joe Fidgen, after the news.
BBC News with Jonathan Izard. Princess Cristina of Spain, the youngest daughter of King Juan Carlos, is being questioned by a judge in Mallorca over allegations of fraud. It's the first time in Spain's history that a member of the royal family has appeared in court. She's being investigated over the business dealings of her husband. Both deny wrongdoing. The long-running case has undermined support for the monarchy. The United Nations says the number of civilians killed in the conflict in Afghanistan rose 14% last year, making it one of the worst years since the fall of the Taliban in 2001. A UN report says nearly 3,000 civilians were killed and more than 5,600 injured in 2013. The UN is hoping to deliver food and medical supplies to civilians trapped by fighting in the Syrian city of Homs. Aid convoys are due to enter on the second day of a ceasefire. On Friday, more than 80 people were evacuated from rebel-held areas, which have been under siege for 18 months. At the Winter Olympics in Sochi, five gold medals will be decided today, including the men's 5,000-metre speed skating and slope-style snowboarding. A record number of new events has been introduced at the Games in Russia. Inspectors from the United Nations Nuclear Agency, the IAEA, are holding talks today with Iranian officials in Tehran. Under an interim deal reached in November, Iran has agreed to freeze its nuclear program for 6 months in return for the easing of international sanctions. Iran insists its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. The Japanese authorities have issued a severe storm warning for Tokyo after the city was hit by heavy snow. Residents have been urged to stay indoors. It's the first such warning for Tokyo in 13 years. 3 months after Typhoon Haiyan devastated the Philippines, prime advertising sites around the world have been lit up with a message of thanks for help in relief and reconstruction. Times Square in New York and Shibuya Crossing in Tokyo were among the locations that displayed the message. BBC News.
Welcome back to My War, My Playlist with me, Jo Fidgham. We've been hearing how music has influenced soldiers' experience and memories of war. In part two, we'll hear about the lifestyle of those soldiers currently serving in Afghanistan and whether easy access to music, films and the internet makes the separation from home easier or harder. Don't you wish your girlfriend
was wrong like me? Pussycat Dolls and Don't Ya.
BFBS.
Hello and welcome to the
Andy Asprey is a presenter and producer for British Forces Radio and broadcasts daily from Camp Bastion.
Top temperature in Camp Bastion today, 14 degrees is our high. Kandahar, you've got 13. Kabul, just walking around Bastion from time to time, one thing I have noticed, and it always puts a smile on my face, is the sort of variety of vehicles that you get here. We're not just talking military vehicles. A number of the Padres drive around on their quad bikes, but they're getting to become known as God Quads, and they're kind of like pimped out. And you're kind of wondering what they're going to do to it next.
My first impressions were how hot it was out here. I arrived at the end of September and it was blisteringly hot.
When a new deployment of British soldiers arrived in Camp Bastion last autumn, Army Chaplain David Barrett went with them.
Huge place, lots of dust and lots of soldiers milling around. And it took quite a bit of time just to get used to it and find my feet and find my way around. It's a big old place.
All right, mate.
It's Gunner Robin Darcy's first deployment to Afghanistan. He's 19 years old.
In my bed space right now, I look to my left and I've got my hanging wardrobe. It's like a material hanging with lots of different sections where I keep my wash kit in, all the stuff that I'd need to get ready for the day. And then I'll keep my boots by my bed at the bottom, along with my flip-flops, and keep everything in bags, really, everything else, living out of bags. We're all trying to make it as homely as possible. Make that a little bit better bit. Everybody's got a morning tune that they like to play, and it's whoever wakes up first. Typical tunes that I'd probably listen to when I'm getting ready for work or to go out on an op or something like that would be something fast to get me motivated, get me thinking and stuff like that. So I'd probably play a bit of Steve Aoki. Maybe some tunes just to put you into a bit of deep thought as well.
I'm Sergeant Major David Boysell from 3rd Regiment Royal Horse Artillery. I wanted the fame but not the
cover of Newsweek. There's loads to do in Bastion. Loads of good gyms, spend a lot of time in the gym, train twice a day. There's coffee shops. If you really want to, you can go to Pizza Hut or KFC and all that type of stuff. They do good steaks down the Blue PX, so we go down there once a month. So I'm not listening to music anywhere near as much. So I have downloaded the new Eminem album. That's on in the gym a lot.
One sheep, two sheep, kung fu, kung fu. Yeah, we're just going past some tented accommodation here in some gyms, and by a place where you can buy some coffee, have a sit down and relax. That's the generator there, which is giving out some air conditioning, I think. I'm just heading towards the church. Barbers. We're just coming into the area where the church tent is. We've got a little office by the side of it, which we call the God Pod. And here we are at the church.
When I first got here, I was a bit shocked because I didn't expect to see like a miniature city just to be in the middle of the desert. It was quite weird actually, seeing people having salsa nights and dancing around and stuff like that. I didn't really expect it.
During 5 years in the army, Patrick Hennessy experienced life in a range of large international bases where entertainment and shopping facilities spring up in the middle of a war zone.
The multinational element was probably one of the most fun things about being in these camps. You know, the national stereotypes kind of came to the fore. The Danes had fantastic food and ended up having to ban British soldiers from sneaking into their cookhouse because they always had sort of fresh salmon and lovely bread. The flip side of that is that quite a lot of the other nations, particularly the Estonians who were down there, they quite liked coming to a Brit cookhouse because you'd get a better curry. And then up in Baghdad, you know, the Americans were absolutely huge in their gyms, you know, kind of working on weights that I couldn't have picked up with the help of another soldier. We just used to find it so funny driving around this huge base in this massive pickup that we had, because that was the sort of vehicles inside the base, with lights dipped, playing something that was more kind of associated with kind of early 90s hip-hop video, because it was the closest thing to cruising around South Central LA you're ever going to get. I mean, there was a sort of conscious irony to that as well, but also, you know, it was the sort of music you'd come up with.
This is one of the final missions for British troops in Afghanistan. In preparation for the total withdrawal of the International Security Force by the end of this year, the Afghan police and army are taking over responsibility for security in their country.
The mobile phone is starting to become bigger and bigger in Afghanistan, so they tend to play a lot of their Afghan local music on their phones, and at times they've heard us whistling to a song or something and they go, Mr, listen to this. I've done quite a bit of training throughout my career, and I've trained all sorts of people, Omanis, Jordanians, Brits, you know, but of the Afghans have been so different. A lot of them, although they are intelligent people, have never been taught to read or write. So when I'm trying to teach them how to do a technical drill in which they need to write data down, they can't write. So you have to teach them the shapes of what they have to write and then try and explain what those shapes are through the interpreter. So it's been completely different from what I've ever experienced before. I thought I was quite a good trainer until I came here, and I've had to completely change the way I train people. The easiest way that I found is every Afghan's a Barcelona supporter, and I'm a Manchester United supporter, so I always break the ice that way and say, who's a Manchester United fan? They all say, no, mister, I'm a Barcelona fan. So I wind them up and say they've all failed the course before they've started because they support the wrong team. You do relax together, but they relax in a different way to us, and we always have to be on our guard.
Music and sport can help overcome the linguistic and cultural barriers, but given the sporadic attacks on NATO forces by their Afghan counterparts, so-called green-on-blue attacks, even a game of cricket can't be completely relaxed, as Stephen Taylor from Four Rifles confidence discovered.
Confidence stride out to the pitch.
We used to go over, I think it was a Friday, and we used to have sports days.
14 for one.
But the lads used to go over, play football and cricket. I used to be guardian angel.
It's a good shot. Looks like that's going to go all the way. Ooh.
Guardian angel meaning if there's a security risk, you just used to be there with all your kit and weapon. You have to look out for the body language and what all sorts of signs and signals, but they're a good bunch of us with the Afghan army this time round.
21-year-old Adam Evans has recently returned from his first deployment to Afghanistan.
Before I left, I was nervous, but I wasn't sure what to expect. You just want to get out there, and it was good to understand the way they live and the way they look after each other. Like, out there, you wouldn't really see the women, and then you'd see the kids, 5 to 12, they're on the farm, like, herding cattle, doing the grass, everything. Like, they really worked hard.
Rifleman Evans was based at Patrol Base Folad, an area constantly under threat from Taliban attack.
Let's go.
His unit was trying to flush out the Taliban by tracing the source of their weapons. This was dangerous territory, and they never knew what they might face as they went out on patrol.
We'd go out pretty much every time they'd shoot us, so we'd build up a few bits of intelligence. Follow the weapons and then send out the foxhounds. They're like the 4x4 jeeps, but armoured. That was the actual driver. We tried to push out at night, so they're still in their sleep. Drive cross-country, find out where they are, and then find the right compound. And then we just rush up, we shout stop.
Stop.
Everyone stops, everyone jumps out the back, and then just run to the front door. Have a little like scan if there's no IDs on the doors or anything.
You call the owner out. Okay, watch those doorways.
Put the door through and then just run in when they're asleep. Element of surprise so they don't run off and arrest them there. You never know what you're going to expect. You never know if you're going to get there and get shot at straight away. So it's exciting. It's rushing. You don't know what's going to happen.
We're sorry, but we need to search it because people are firing.
For our first foxhound drive before we left, we had a boombox played and we took it to the front gate and played the regimental music before we left the gate as like a morale little thing to get ready for it.
All sorts of music can bring soldiers together. Captain Doug Beattie has done 3 tours of Afghanistan since 2006 and believes it's important to create the right spirit before going out on patrol.
Met up with a gambler. We were both too tired to sleep.
Kenny Rogers, the gambler. We used to put this on when we were going out on patrol and it would play as the guys were wandering about, sort of putting on their kit or sorting out their weapon.
He said, son, I've made a life.
And we all knew that as soon as we were going out the gate, the likelihood we were going to be in contact. And you could see people in the corners of the compound mouthing the words. And every so often, a couple of the guys would start singing it really, really loudly. I remember once when I gave my final orders for the patrol, and we'd all sort of lined up in the order of march that we'd be going, and I was second back, and the guy with the mine detector thing was in front of me. And as we were patrolling out the gate, the guy who wasn't going put on the gambler. And you know, you could hear these guys with ballistic goggles on, with their helmets down, with earpieces in, all singing away to the gambler as they patrolled out. But it really was a way of bringing people together.
You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
Patrick Hennessy served in Afghanistan in 2007.
Well, one of the great things about being an officer is you could put your foot down when it came to music selection. It's like the ultimate driver's privilege. We had a little speaker system wedged into the front of my command vehicle, and we would make up little playlists if we were going to go out on a long drive or a long patrol. And inevitably, we found ourselves being shot at and shooting back. And the next song that came on the shuffle was Dolly Parton, 9 to 5. And there's that sort of silly Western kind of jolly, and conjures up visions of the 80s. And we all, you know, had these sort of slightly silly grins on. Burst out laughing in the middle of this contact because that was sort of what our 9 to 5 felt like.
Brandon Neal joined the army at 16 and was really looking forward to his first tour of Afghanistan in 2013. During his time there, he accompanied the Afghan National Army, or ANA, on patrols that would last several days at a time.
We'd follow the ANA as they make up ground and complete their objectives, like clearing IED factories, going into certain bits of ground that they've maybe not been in before. And so, obviously, there's a lot of time where we were covering ground inside the warhogs, but in the back, there's nothing much we could do, so it was just getting your heads down. I remember on the bumpy gravel, I was listening to the Libertines, Don't Look Back Into the Sun, which was quite funny because it was just kind of like sunset. and you have little windows and you look out and you just see like the Afghan train, obviously it's completely different to England, to like whizzing past you. Yeah, it was just kind of surreal.
Don't look back into the sun. Now you know that the time has come. And they said it would never come for you.
Music does play a massive part in what we do.
Lance Corporal Colby Johnson is currently stationed at Lashkargah in southern Helmand with 3 Royal Anglian.
All we need is music player, small speaker, and it can boost the morale of the lads straight away. Funniest songs are the cheesiest music you can find. Guys will be sitting there chilling out, and all of a sudden someone will put a tune on, and everyone's like, get it off, but everyone still sings along to it. We have a few dance-offs and things like that. Sometimes you'll leave your room and all of a sudden some garbage in the hallway just busting a few moves. So then you try and get involved and why not? And then you're taking someone else's tent and there's people saying, get out! Our favourite dance-off tune is Sex and I Know It, because obviously it's an outrageous video. We can't get that outrageous out here, but I'm sure when we get back to Cottesmore it will be crazy. I'm sexy and I know it. I think we kind of scared a lot of people off because we've got moves. I'm sexy and I know
it. You're listening to My War, My Playlist on the BBC World Service. Soldiers serving in Afghanistan are surrounded by so much that is familiar. The internet, television, gyms and burger bars can create an illusion of home. But a simple phone call can shatter that. Stephen Taylor.
Whilst you're on the phone to them, it feels almost for a second that you're not in Afghanistan, you're actually at home phoning them up, seeing how they're doing. But then, after the conversation, and you've hung up, as you walk away, to be honest, you do actually feel a little bit sad, because it's like, I've just spoken to the people I love. You walk off and you're like, oh, great, I'm still in Afghanistan.
You're much more connected to home. You think immediately, well, that makes the separation easier. Actually, we found it sometimes made it difficult. I sort of slightly pretentiously used to like the romance of the bluey, the old fold-up single piece of mail that you would write on in biro, and I was kind of religiously used to write my friends and family on an old letter, which kind of kept an illusion of maybe more distance than there was. But that distance, even if it was slightly false, made what you were going through easier.
Yeah, lad.
Next on the list.
My first letter I got was from my girlfriend. Oh, it's brilliant. It's one of the best feelings in the world. I know it sounds strange, but whilst you're out there, it's so personal. It's like, wow. Do you know what I mean? People do actually care back home. When I used to write back, I used to always make sure it was late at night, looking up at the stars, and then I'll write back. It was wonderful. The night is probably the best thing about Afghanistan, because obviously in the UK, you have buildings and stuff getting in the way and mist maybe in the sky. Whereas in Afghanistan, it's just completely clear. You see stars like they're almost touching you. The night is so much more beautiful than in the UK.
You get these fantastic moons in Afghanistan. No light pollution. And this haunting kind of desert vision, silhouettes, kind of all iconic imagery from any kind of war film you'd care to mention. And for some reason, about 3 times in a row, when I was doing this kind of little night runaround, I had Pink Floyd's The Great Gig in the Sky, which was on my iPod, which is absolutely perfect, because you've got that huge vocal entry. Belting kind of wail. And then the much more kind of relaxed tunefulness. And this almost so faint as to be inaudible guy saying, I'm not frightened of dying. I think that was my best wind down song for anywhere I ever went.
Comment on the pool, Nick.
At Camp Folad, 4 Rifles found a new way to wind down.
What's that floating there?
We managed to get a plastic swimming pool sent out with a filter and managed to rig it up to the camp's water, which was from the Neb Canal. And then we got a generator to the filter and got that running, but that didn't work very long. It went green after 3 days.
Just do 360 pictures,
then. And we'll get ready to get in the swimming pool. All in our shorts and t-shirts and flip-flops, And then the first bang went off. We thought nothing of it. Then the second one went off. Didn't really think much of it. Then the third went off and the snipers came up saying, lads, we're getting bombed, like they're coming into camp. So then we all ran off and got in hard cover under our beds and that. With no shoes on and shorts, just in body armour and helmet, with their weapon ready to like, react to anything that did happen. And then it went on for about 20 minutes, just kept landing every so often. And then towards the end of it, we heard his man down. And then a lad had been hit, nothing serious, he just went through his leg.
You have to be very conscious about the guy's well-being when they're not out on patrol or they're not in combat. And it's even more important when we lose somebody.
Captain Doug Beattie.
When we were in the Upper Esk Valley in this checkpoint, this was in 2008, I sadly did lose one of my soldiers and it was really tragic. And when you come back from something like that, there's no consoling anybody. Even me as a commander felt an absolute abject failure having lost one of my soldiers on parade. And I knew my soldiers were feeling exactly the same way, where they wanted to go away and get their kit sorted out. They didn't want to talk and they wanted to grieve on their own. May you always do for others. And the song by Bob Dylan, Forever Young, was then always sort of prevalent to me because I thought not just about the man who was killed, but his family. May you build a ladder to... And that this family would always ever remember that man who left his home to go to Afghanistan, never to come back, and he would always be forever young. Whereas I will grow older, I will change, and I will slip into insignificance. And it just matched my mood, I think, in those days. Forever. And there's that numb feeling because you have lost a colleague and realising that the next step you have got to do is to go back into your patrol base and start to gather up his belongings. And while they're doing that in that sober fashion, you as the commander have got to go to a computer somewhere and sit down and start to write an absolutely anodyne account of what happened. And having to do that straight away is extremely difficult. And I remember sort of writing and then coming out, and I was standing against the wall, reflective and sad, and I could feel my emotions welling up. And one of my private soldiers, we call them Rangers, walked up to me and he put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Are you all right, boss?" Forever young. And just looking at his face brought me round in an absolute instant. Because when I looked into his face, I knew that he had a genuine concern for me and he was grieving in exactly the same way. And I sort of punched him on the shoulder and said, "Look, yeah, I'm a good fella, let's get on with this." And for me, it was a very poignant moment.
Documentary maker Sean Langan was trying to film the Taliban when things went badly wrong.
Despite all the horrors you see in Afghanistan, all the hardships, the danger, many people, including myself, fall head over heels in love with the place, both the people and the epic landscape. And I think really I'd become slightly blind to the dangers. And so in 2007, 2008, I decided to cross the border from Afghanistan into the tribal areas of Pakistan to make a documentary about the secret training camps of Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And I was inevitably kidnapped by the Taliban. So in 2008, I spent 3.5, 4 months in captivity. I was cut off from the outside world in a dark room with no sunlight. But strangely enough, the Taliban, and I'm very grateful for this, allowed me to have a radio. So this radio was our window onto the world, and it was very much the world service. And to me, it was the difference between sanity and insanity. And then one day, out of the blue, was this very famous classical choral piece. I think it's Allegri's Miseri. And I'd been told by the Taliban that the chance I was going to be executed the next day. And I'm in a dark room, cut off from my family, and then I hear this music, which to me got closer than any written word to the idea that there may be a God. But it seemed to fill the room with light, and it was one of the most beautiful sounds I'd ever heard. And I knew I was going to die. My last request was not to have my throat cut, but could I be shot in the back of the head? Because I, oddly enough, like a lot of people, a bit odd about having my throat cut. And they agreed. At that point, I was filled with love. I made my peace. I've never felt so connected to my loved ones and my children. But bizarrely, when you leave that place, return to London, that's when all the darkness, the fear you've kept at bay, comes back to haunt you. And so ironically, now it unfortunately reminds me of my time in captivity. So yeah, I'd rather not be reminded too much of what happened inside there. I think like many people who went to Afghanistan, whether it's soldiers, aid workers, journalists, it leaves its mark on you. And the way I think about it is, including my kidnap, it was a price worth paying for such an intense, incredible experience.
It's an overcast December day, and the men of Four Rifles are practicing for their medals parade through Salisbury. Brandon Neal, Adam Evans, and Stephen Taylor have all recently returned from their tour of Afghanistan.
I've been put forward for a promotion to a Lance Corporal, which is quite good because I'm still 19. So I've worked hard, and I look forward to getting that and then climbing the promotion ladder.
Coming home is so different. You expect everyone to still be going at 100 mile an hour, but then when you get home to your friends, still doing the same thing over and over again. And like in this job, you ask someone to do something, they'll do it. You ask someone else, they won't do it. I found I got a bit angry with them.
Your army friends, once you're on the front line with them, you know, they're there to save your life, you're there to save their life, and that's it. You put them almost first. And that's why it's such a good sort of like brotherhood, and they are like family. Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of
ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. People would often ask, are you glad to be home? And obviously you were, but there would always be a part of you that misses some of the experiences that I had.
Patrick Hennessy.
And that seems a very strange concept. How can you miss what was, on the face of it, a very difficult and very traumatic time? And one of the answers is that I found myself working in a team with absolute interdependence. And the longer we worked together and the more exposed we were to difficult situations, the greater synergy there was. And I hear Dolly Parton and I immediately associate it with the kind of silliness and frivolity that I'm sure somebody looking from a long way away would disapprove of. But to me, it's kind of symptomatic of our ability to do our jobs and keep a sense of humour. It's a very warm memory, counterintuitive as though that might be.
That was My War, My Playlist. It was produced by Deborah Dudgeon and narrated by me, Joe Fidgen. It was a Whistledown production for the BBC World Service.